you didn't already know, Roz Chass is a pretty big deal. Her cartoons have appeared in The New Yorker since 1978 and in dozens of other publications. In 2014, her memoir, Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant, became the first graphic novel ever to appear as a finalist in the nonfiction category of the National Book Award. Also in 2014, Roz received a Rubin Award, which is given out by an organization called the National Cartoonist Society, made up of members who are all professional cartoonists. If you are a cartoonist, getting a Rubin is like winning the Oscar. And I might add, since 1946, the Rubin has only gone to two other women. One was Lynn Johnston in 1985 for her comic For Better or For Worse. And the other was to Kathy Geiswhite in 1992 for Kathy. In my mind, Roz is a certifiable genius. Her cartoons take tiny moments from daily life and pull out the funny in them. They're absurd and silly and sometimes sad, as I'm sure you all know. If you missed her exhibition Cartoon Memoirs this past fall at the Museum of the City of New York, you can see it in San Francisco, where it currently is at the Contemporary Jewish Museum now through September 3rd. If you won't be on the West Coast anytime soon, that's okay. We have Theories of Everything available for purchase tonight in the Peluso Family Exhibition Gallery, which is a collection of three decades of Roz's comics and is mandatory bookshelf material as far as I'm concerned. We'll be opening up the floor tonight for questions after the presentation. And for now, please join me in welcoming Roz Chass.
This guy is falling. This guy is, oh look, part of the bagel. This is a relatively recent one. I think we should start dating other people. This is not the mood for you. This is the little engine that wouldn't. I don't care about bills. I want to be a writer. This cartoon is when moms dance. People sometimes ask, where do you get your ideas for cartoons? And most of the time, I can't tell you, but this one actually came directly from life. When my daughter was around 16, she was doing her homework in the living room and listening to music, I don't know if you can tell, just 10 years ago on a boombox, and listening to some sort of hip-hop sort of thing. And, you know, in the eyes of a teenager, there's almost nothing more disgusting than the sight of an adult human body. And I kind of understand that, you know, but now. But if you really want to gild that lily, just do a little dance. And you will see this look of horror on your face. And I think partly, like, I knew this, but I just wanted to see if she was paying attention. So I kind of came in, and I was like, and she looked up, and she said, Mom, stop, you're hurting me. And I asked her if I could use it as a line, and she said, sure, go ahead. She didn't even make me pay her. This is Little Red Riding Hood in Dallas. Published a little bit in the Village Voice and National Lampoon, And my goal, my dream of dreams, was to actually get a regular slot at, in the Village Voice. Not at the New Yorker. My parents subscribed to the New Yorker. Of course, I knew they used cartoons. I was a huge Charles Adams fan. We'll talk a little bit more about that later. But I had no ambition towards the New Yorker because I did not see myself in there at all. But still, there weren't many magazines, even in 1978, that were using cartoons. There was them and Playboy, and that was even farther afield. So I packed up my stuff. I found out when their drop-off day was. That's like, you know, dropping off your stuff over the transom, basically. And I packed up about 60 cartoons, and I went back the next week to pick up my portfolio. And I, you know, looked inside for the rejection note. And instead, there was a note from Lee Lorenz, who was the cartoon, the art editor, telling me to come back and see him. But I had no idea why. You know, I had this, you know how you sort of picture things before they happen? I sort of pictured him saying to me, like, what a little lady. You know, maybe, but I don't know why I made like a Western cowboy. I don't quite know why he chose this one, because it was probably the most personal of all of the cartoons in, that I had submitted, most oddball, and the kind of thing that, like, when I'm, you know, by myself and I want to make myself laugh, you know, and I just kind of make up these, you know, when you just kind of drop your game. Well, I mean, I do this, maybe you don't do this. You know, I'll make up, like, names that, like, spell. You know, I don't know, just like I like to make myself laugh. So, and maybe it won't translate to anybody else. But anyway, that's what this really pretty much was. And when they ran it, people were like, the barbarians are not just at the gates, they are through the doors. It was a couple people canceled their subscriptions. And years later, I didn't know that at the time, Lee told me. Years later, Lee told me that one of the older cartoonists actually asked if we owed my family money. anyway, this is another really early one. Voice of Reason. It's not such a big thing. Just put the galoshes on. And Voice of Conscience. Mom will be mad if you don't put them on. The Voice of Practicality. It's raining. Why don't you just wear them? The Voice of Thinking. Off my moon. And this is another really early one. The crowd was 1,022,766. Part of the reason I like this cartoon, though, is, well, I'll tell you a little bit about how the process was. We all submit sketches. The cartoonists submit sketches, groups of sketches every week. And they, at the time, when we would meet in person with the editor, if you sold a cartoon, Lee would pull the cartoon out, he'd pull the sketch out, and he'd say, we're going to buy this one, and then you take it home and you make it good, you do the finish. But he said, we're going to buy this one, but then he pointed to the mailbox, which looked sort of similar to this one, except that I had that little flag deal, like sort of sticking out perpendicularly and attached to the front of the box. And he pointed to it, and he said, what is that? And I said, well, that's the handle. That's how you open up the front of the box. And he looked at me kind of strangely. And I had to sort of explain that I really, this was before the internet when I could Google that kind of mailbox. I grew up in an apartment house, you know. I had never had one of these sort of mailboxes. And I had the sketch someplace. He actually explained the logistics of the mechanics, I should say, of what these kinds of mailboxes were, with the flag and like how you had mail, you know, in the box, you put the flag up. And now, like, I don't want to brag, but like I'm really good at these mailboxes. I just like flip that flag up like I've been doing it my whole life. We're on a weekly schedule. There's about 40 of us, 40, 50 cartoonists under contract. Every week, as I said, we all submit a group of sketches. This could be like 6, 8, 10 separate ideas. In fact, the cartoons in the New Yorker used to be called idea drawings because they were not called cartoons because they weren't just cartoons. It was like the drawing had to have this idea. And I still think of them like that. It's like you get an idea and then you draw it. It's not just, you know, a cartoony looking illustration. It's an idea drawing. You know, when you think about the odds of all this, well, okay, so this is where I work. And then I send them through cyberspace. And this is an actual photograph of drawings going through cyberspace. Now it's actually changing, and everybody is sending them electronically. I think for a while, people did come in person. Some people, maybe some people faxed them in. But when you think of the odds about this, the drawings all go to, we're faxing them to the New Yorker, to the cartoon editor. And there's 40 cartoonists on staff, about, and let's just say for the ease of math, we submit 10 sketches. 400, and then another 400 come in over the transom. That's 800 cartoons, and they buy about 20, 22 drawings a week. The odds are very much stacked against you. I get rejected all the time. I think if you can do anything else, you really should do that. Belcos at home. amazing. And I almost had a sad thing happen to me too. I can hardly speak about it without crying. And speaking of bon voyage, guess where I'm going? France. Many years ago, I was asked to go to Hallmark Cards. And I had this kind of funny encounter. I was asked to talk to the people who make the cards, and it was this group of, I don't know, about 20 people, and I was explaining my favorite genre of card, which is like when you go to the grocery store or the drugstore, and there are these like trifold cards, and they're usually like there's some pastel background with like a sunset or a beach, or there's like a boat on the water, and plants, flowers, pretty bad. And then there's like some weird poem, like, I know the sun rises, the water drifts up and down. Sometimes there's misunderstanding, and it's just like misunderstandings with the water flowing up and down. And I was talking about this, and so usually just somebody like messed up and they want to apologize, you know, but it's like some horrible poem. And I was laughing, and then I looked up and there was nobody there was laughing. And it was suddenly like, oh, really awkward. So yeah. This is I like that you put over the hole. I don't know. Wear a shower cap all the time? I don't know. really, and if you didn't feel like hanging yourself before you were shown in high school, you're going to be crawling down to the desk like really fast. It's pretty bad. This is from his collection also. I love this. It's so junky. Isn't this a beautiful little wagon? It is light. Runs like a bicycle. One horse is a plenty. We build it ourselves. We want a bicycle delivered at the railroad station. St. Louis Coffin Company. But this is from my collection, and this is real. This was an ad in a funeral record magazine. My mom always wanted the very best. Mom was really something. She always made sure I had the biggest birthday party and the prettiest dress at the prom. She'd say, honey, you deserve the best of everything. Even boyfriends. It seems no boy was ever really good enough for me. Then I fell in love with Joe. She was so proud of me on my wedding day. Her eyes sparkled through the tears. She hugged me and wished me the best possible happiness. Years later, she jokingly told me, probably could have done better. But he's helping the best grandchildren. She never stopped giving me her best love and attention. It's my turn now, Mom, to give you the best. Before I go into it, I thought I'd put, this is one of my favorite poems. Then your head fills up with water, then you die. Laughing during a meal, yelled at for laughing because then you could like choke. I think one of the weirdest ones was that I wasn't allowed to sit directly on the ground because my mother knew a girl who sat directly on the ground and she caught a cold in her kidneys and she shocked me. Things like not sitting too close to the TV, that's pretty common. Or one time I found this watch band, this not watch band, a little bracelet thing on the street, and it had one of those like expandable sort of wrist things. And my mother said, take that off, it's too tight, your hand will get gangrene and drop off. Lesson learned. My parents and I never discussed death. So you guys ever think about things? What kinds of things? You know, things. Fans. I have no idea what you guys want. Let's say something happened. Am I the only sane person here? You know what? Forget it. Never mind. Case or Oscar. Later that same day. Phew. 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 None of us wanted to talk about this. It's a horrible topic. I was quite aware that my parents had had tough lives, way, way tougher than mine. I had heard the stories my whole life about how their parents had come over from Russia at the turn of the century with nothing, and how my maternal grandfather had been an engineer in Russia, but between his inability to speak English and his being Jewish, he wound up barely being able to support five kids and his wife working as a presser in the garment district, and how bitter and angry he was, and how my grandmother washed clothes for other people, and how even sadder my father's family was. His mother was one of nine children. Not only was she the only girl, but she was also the only one of her siblings to survive the Russian cholera epidemic. Then in a forest, her father had his throat cut from ear to ear by bandits. This is the story I heard. I don't know what happened to her mother, but she came to New York, married my paternal grandfather, and had just one child, my father, by cesarean section in 1912. A horrible ordeal that involved, according to my mother, cutting her open from her neck to her you-know-what. Between their one bad thing after another lives in the Depression, World War II, and the Holocaust in which they both lost family, it was amazing that they weren't crazier than they were. Who could blame them for not wanting to talk about death? And my father is saying, let's discuss a more pleasant subject. That's where the title of this book comes from him. My parents referred to each other without any irony as soulmates. The rocks in his head matched the holes in mine. I heard that a lot. They were born 11 days apart, and they grew up two blocks apart in East Harlem, New York City. They were in the same fifth grade class. They never dated, much less anything else, anyone besides each other. My father says, we were too poor. Aside from the World War II, work, illness, and going to the bathroom, they did everything together. I'm going to Waldo's. Hold on, I'm coming too. My mother even washed my father's hair for him. It's not as if they never fought, because they did. Don't sit sideways, you're twisting your kishkes. Kishkes are Yiddish for intestines. But the concept of looking for something better, or being happy, that was for modern people and movie stars, i.e. degenerates. They were a tight little unit. Codependent, of course we're codependent, thank God. Maybe they believed if they just held on to each other really, really tightly for eternity, nothing would ever change. I visited them for the first time in years at their apartment in Brooklyn where I grew up. What I noticed first was the level of grime. What is grime? It's not ordinary dust or a greasy stovetop that hasn't been cleaned in a week or two. It's more of a coating. It's something that happens when people haven't cleaned in a really long time. One thing my mother always told me when I was growing up was, you have to dust. If you don't, the dust gets into all the interstices of the furniture and it breaks it all apart. It was clear that she had stopped worrying about that. But what do? If you pick up a sponge and start cleaning, it will not necessarily be perceived as helpful. The person you're trying to help might even feel insulted or embarrassed. Put that down. Leave that alone. Don't touch that. Daddy and I are fine. Is that your mother? I wasn't great as a caretaker, and they weren't great at being taken care of. This is a sort of typical conversation that I had with my mother around that time when things were just starting to kind of change. How's your cataract? removal operation coming, recovery coming along.
Right.
It's like there was a yellow scrim over everything, and now it's gone. Oh, I should say here that my father never learned how to drive. He was too anxious. My mother did all the driving. They lived in Brooklyn. I still have a patch over the eye, though. But not to worry, there's plenty of food in the house. Daddy and I just got back from wall bounce. And I'm thinking, oh my God, I know where that wall bounce is. It's across Ocean Parkway. I don't know if any of you guys know Ocean Parkway, but it's a very big, busy avenue. I think it's 6 lanes in Brooklyn. It's not what you want. You know, I'm picturing her like this, and she's this little person with a big car. And I said, Mom, listen to me. You can't drive with one eye. You have no depth perception. And she says, not a problem. Daddy guided me. This is another conversation. Around the same time, I went to visit them, and I pick up this oven mitt, and I say, Mom, what is with this oven mitt? It's from the year one. It's disgusting. It's all burnt and cruddy. It's got patches on it. Oh, my God. These patches come from a skirt I made 40 years ago in home after. Please let me buy you a new oven mitt. And she says, why waste your money? That one still works. By 2002, they were 90. It was hard not to notice that every time I came to see them, the barn had grown thicker, the piles of newspapers, magazines, and junk mail had grown larger, and they themselves had grown frailer. I could see that they were slowly leaving the sphere of TV commercial old age. And this is like those ads for Central Silver that just cracked me up. You know, it's like some guy who's like 72, and he's healthy, and he's got silver hair, and he's like kayaking or something. And moving into the part of old age that was scarier, harder to talk about, and not a part of his culture. And here is this scientist saying, extend human lifespan to 140. I'm thinking, like, who does he think is going to help take care? It's probably his sister. Or, you know, or something was coming down the pipe. It's no accident that most consumer ads are pitched to people in their 20s and 30s. For one thing, they are less likely to have gone through the transformative process of cleaning out their deceased parents' stuff. Mm-hmm. Once you go through that, you can never look at your stuff in the same way. You start to look at your stuff a little post-mortem. If you live more than 2 decades as a consumer, you probably have quite the accumulation, even if you're not a hoarder. An ergonomic garlic press, and throw pillows, and those stupid sunflower dessert plates, and 7 travel alarm clocks, and 8 nail clippers, and a colander, and a flat iron, and 3 old laptops, and barbells, and a set of fucking bocce balls, and patio furniture, and an autocar for God's sake, and your old flutes from high school, and a zillion books, and towels and sheets, and a walk you never use, and that was the tip of the iceberg. And this is, my mother had very mixed feelings. As I said, she was a sort of Dr. Monte, and she was fascinated by all things medical. But as far as she herself went, she was very tough. You know, she was kind of like a very old Russian sock, and she just did not believe in going to the doctor for everything. She just, like, she would just pull her way through things that I knew that people half her age would be running to the doctor, and, you know, but she just felt, well, this is the sort of thing that she would say. She's doctors. They have a God complex. They tell you to do something, and a month later, it's never do that thing. Some people think doctors walk on water, but not me. And hospitals? Don't get me started. Here's what I think about hospitals. That's where you go to die. The body wants to be well. I'm a Jewish Christian scientist. And, you know, that really did work for her for many, many, many decades. And it wasn't until she was about 92, 93, I think, a little bit in the book where she was taken to the hospital, and it was terrible. And my father came to live with us for a little while she was in the hospital. It was 3 weeks, and it turned out he had more senility than I knew, because when he was with my mother, it was, you know, the symptoms were masked. It was really eye-opening and sort of sad and terrible. And then finally she got out of the hospital, and for another year they continued to live in that apartment. My father went back, of course, with her. And I would try still to get them to talk about things. Besides their aversion to talking about unpleasant topics, they also had trust issues. Remember the Melvins? Before they died, they signed all their money over to their daughter, and here's the the four Melmans, and then their daughter was just this ne'er-do-well, and they're handing her this big bag of money, and she's going, yeah, thanks. Next thing you know, she puts them in a nursing home. Off you go. And she buys a drawer full of cashmere sweaters. I tried to get them to accept even a little bit of help from the outside, but they didn't want strangers in the apartment. My mother insisted that no grocery store in Brooklyn delivered. Occasionally one of their neighbors helped out, but the grime and disorder were worse than ever, way worse than anything a mere tidying up would fix. I would periodically try to do like little tidying things where she couldn't see me, and I discovered this ancient box of sanitary napkins in the towel closet. They were so old, they were covered with dust, they were so old that the graphics predated the time, and it still predated a woman, and I just, they were like, why? Are you going to make doll dads out of these? Are you going to like pad shoes with them? I could not figure this out. Like, why didn't you just say it was in this incinerator chute at the end of the hallway? I mean, I don't know. And it was only getting worse. A friend of mine said, you have found the source of the River Ede. At any time I mentioned assisted living, the reaction was extremely negative. And you know, these places have these ridiculous names. Sunset Gardens, End of the Trail Acres, Final Bridge, Rest Home. Somehow they were able to see through the euphemisms. And then finally, various things happened, and they really could not stay in the apartment anymore. And they came, I found a place that was about 10 minutes from me, very nice place. But, you know, still a place, you know. Finally, they were there. And this is like a sort of compression the first few days. My father is saying, so what do they call this place, a rest home? No, Dad, it's called assisted living. I'm trying to put a good face on this. And then when I see these posters on the wall that are just nuts, don't forget the trip to the mall. Jimmy leaves the lobby from the lobby at 1 p.m. Tonight's dining room theme is outer space. That bothered me a lot. Because, you know, this was not like the Alzheimer wing or something like that. This was just for like people who were old who maybe needed a little extra help, you know, maybe taking a shower or getting dressed. The infantilization, and I just thought that was so unnecessary and weird, really. Like, why would my parents suddenly want an outer space theme dinner? Alfonso the Amazing does his magic act, and you know, but still, I'm trying to kind of put a good face on this. Look, they have a craft center. And my mother is thinking, my daughter equals knitting. And look, there's a gym and a little bar if you want to get a drink before dinner, and bingo, all day long. Have never been to a gym, don't drink, don't play bingo. And my mother says, I'm getting fatigued, let's go back to our room. I always made sure their door had decor. Indian corn, flowers, things like that. No wreaths, one has limits. Door decor was not an important part of my parents' old lives. And this is the truth. It's like, they lived in an apartment house. You didn't put crap on your door, you know, because in my father's and my parents' minds, it was like, okay, they're at the end of the hallway. Robert comes off the elevator, looks down the hallway. He sees the door with the Indian corn on the door. And it's like, those people must be really rich because they have an Indian corn. Anybody could take that. And they could, like, you know, just kind of casually put Indian corn up on. They must have, like, really great stuff in their apartment. So, you know, that was the way they thought. But, you know, but when in Rome, you know, I bought them Indian corn. I did not want the other residents to think they were weird or anti-door decor. So here are two residents walking down the hall. I heard the Chasps are from New York. didn't want that, you know? It wasn't all so great. My father broke his hip. He's 95. And he was done. He was just done. I told Daddy he was coming with me to 100 if I had to drag him kicking and screaming. He entered hospice, which my mother didn't particularly approve of either. So the hospice lady has started coming around. She's very nice, but I told her I don't want anybody coming around with a long, sad face. I'm positive thinking. Not a bunch of people standing around singing Kumbaya. I never heard any of them do that. Well, my father did pass away at 95. My mother lived for another 2 years. And it was kind of an excruciating 2 years. She actually, at one point, went into hospice, but to steal a joke from Art Buchwald, she did so well that she graduated. And it was terrible. It was much more humiliating and sad and painful and expensive and crazy than I could ever have imagined. You know, it was just this part of life that I knew zero about. Here's what I used to think happened at the end. One day, old Mrs. McGillicuddy felt unwell, and she took to her bed. She stayed there for, 3 or 4 weeks, growing weaker day by day. One night, she developed something called the death rattle. Soon after that, she died. Rest in peace, old Mrs. McGillicuddy. You know, I mean, this is the picture I got from movies or, you know, books. I didn't know that after, you know, the 18th hole, there was like 19, 20, 21, 22, 20, you know, it just like went on. As I said, my mother lived another 2 years. And then towards the end, something changed. I mean, it was very strange. She had most of her marbles until the very end when I would come and visit her. And we would be talking about like something totally normal. She'd be asking me about my kids. And then suddenly, she would go into this like story, like no change of voice or anything. She just suddenly, like she'd ask me like, you know, what did you do? How's work? And then, your father died before you were born, but I was pregnant with you. My father, Harry, said he would buy me a house and he would live with us and babysit you while I was at work. And I said, Mom, that's not true. And she said, yes, it is, and I should know. You know, she's a sort of argumentative, very strong person, and so I just kind of left it alone. But there were so many of these stories, I gave them titles. This one is, that one's Dead Dad. Then this one is called Ass Full of Buckshot. There was a brakeman at the place. All the men were moved over to the women's side. I shot the intruder with my BB gun. I gave him an ass full of buckshot. I'd like to stand him on a stage, pull down his pants, and take out the pellets one by one in front of everybody. Then unusual adoption. I have heard this story, but not this version. Did I ever tell you about how the Miltons got Paula? They went out shopping, and when they got back to their car, there was a grocery bag leaning against the wheel, and inside the bag was a baby. I was on a launch, and a woman who was naked down to her pocket, his belly button ish, got stabbed in the heart by a flying swordfish. A terrible way to die. Maybe you dreamed it. Nope, I was right there. So she's having these sort of waking dreams. I mean, maybe, you know, she's having these like little strokes or something. But they weren't constant. You know, then she would like go right back into, you know, regular chit-chat about, you know, how's Ian doing with that, my son, you know, how's he doing with that. Very strange. Of all the stories, I like this one best. When you were around 4, Daddy and I took you to see Uncle Tom's Cabin in Brooklyn College. When Simon Legree was whipping old Uncle Tom, you jumped out of your seat, ran to the stage, and yelled at him to stop hurting Uncle Tom. You said, "You're a bad, bad man." And then you took away his whip. You almost ruined the play. And then we moved into a different part of this story where it got very, very quiet. And she started to sleep almost all the time. And sometimes she'd say hi to me when I came, but most of the time she was asleep. Also, I should say, for the last 2 years, she was not just in the place. She also had a round-the-clock helper. This is one of the things I found out about assisted living that I didn't know, that at a certain point, you sort of top out, you know, with how much help they can offer you. And my mother needed round-the-clock care, pretty much, and the choice was either transfer her to a nursing home, which I did not want to do because she was comfortable there. at the end of September in 2009, she died. And I was not at all planning on going to her, of course. The aide called me to say that she was passing. I tried to be together as fast as I could, but it's quick. And then, you know, if any of you have been through this process, you know that all this official machinery starts to happen where, you know, the aide has to be the head nurse, has to be the hospice person, these forms, everything like that. And I was left with my mother or her body for about 10-15 minutes, and I did not know what else to do. And I thought, this is so weird, this is the last time I'm going to see her. And so I threw her. I wish that at the end of life, when things were truly done, there was something to look forward to. Something more pleasure-oriented, perhaps opium or heroin. So you became addicted, so what? All you can eat ice cream parlors for the extremely aged. Make art picture books, music, extreme palliative care for when you've had it with everything else. The x-rays, the MRIs, the boring blue, and the pills that don't do anything at all. Would that be so bad? And the more I think about it, anyway, this story didn't quite end there. I had a weird, strange thing happen about a year after the book came out. You know, at the end of the book, my parents' ashes are in my closet because they had not told me anything about where they wanted to be buried, or they didn't want to talk about any of that. The only thing that I was going on was that, you know, years before, my mother had sort of, maybe she didn't even mean it, who knows? The only thing she had ever said was like, I don't want to be buried, I want to be cremated. So, you know, they were cremated. But they were in my closet because I did not know where else to put them. And I just did not have a place. Anyway, so about a year and a half ago, I received an email from a woman who had read a book I wrote about my parents. Dear Roz Chass, I read your book, blah, 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 but there was a mystery that needed to be solved. She reassured me that she wasn't Bats, that she was merely curious about where my parents' first baby was buried. Her curiosity led her to a website called Find a Grave, real thing, where she discovered something she thought I might find interesting. She found a record of what my sister. I did find it interesting. It was more information than I was able to get from my parents, so I contacted Mount Lebanon Cemetery, that was the cemetery, and the next day I received this message. Dear Roz, I believe you have found your sister. I was way beyond flabbergasted. Not only had my sister turned up in the archives, but so had my mom's parents. This was all news to me. The man at the cemetery sent me photographs of their graves. My parents' ashes, which had been in my closet since their deaths in 2007 and 2009, had at last found a home. Several months passed. After all, there was no rush. Finally, last fall, my son and I took the subway and then a bus to Glendale, Queens, where Mount Lebanon Cemetery is. I didn't bring the cremains. Two-part process, and this part was maybe for paperwork. We met with a man who had found my sister and my grandparents. He showed us a book of archived cemetery maps and the precise place where my sister was buried. He took us to the gravesite, which was unmarked, common in the case of an infant's death. My son and I put stones on her grave. Jews don't put flowers on graves, just don't. He showed us a niche wall where my parents' remains would be housed, and we have chosen this. He said, it overlooks where your sister is buried, only one left in that wall, it's niche J2. And I was flabbergasted because J2, the apartment where my parents had lived for almost 50 years where I grew up, was 2J. Yeah, weird. The other day I returned to Mount Lebanon, this time with a pal and my parents' cremains. Photo of me on the subway. I was tempted to say to my fellow L train passengers, guess what, or who? A workman drove me to the niche wall. I carried the bag on my lap. We were joined by a group of workmen in the wall. One of them climbed the ladder, opened the niche, and one by one placed my parents' ashes inside. Then he resealed it and climbed back down. It was time to say goodbye. So that's the ending of that story. And And this is in a dress for all. You can see it. There's, this is the Holy Trinity. And it's sort of. And I love Tombstone gags, as you probably have seen in at least two or three there. Tune in or not, dropped in. And now, this is the last slide. This is a book that I just finished. It's going to come out in October. It's called Going Into Town, which is what my parents used to call going into Manhattan from Brooklyn. We're going to go into town. And it's a love letter to New York. And that is it.
Okay, so then I went ahead and did the embroidery.
You know, we had a lot of conversations that really had a lot to do with, you know, one person grows up in Brooklyn and another person grows up in Minnesota. You know, before we moved out of the city, I just remember taking these rides with him to, like, visit people who lived outside the city, and it just didn't make any sense to me. You know, it's just like, especially when you're, like, I understood what towns were, but I didn't understand the, like, stuff, like, you know, if you know, Centerville was over here, and Overshoot was over here, and then there was all this, like, stuff in the middle with, like, the malls and the shopping malls, and I just didn't understand what that was. Like, whether that was a town, or, I don't know. And I remember one time, and I wound up in the cartoon, he actually said to me, "Welcome to the mainland." So this, like, quite a disgust, but yes?
You said you were a staff cartoonist for New York, but sometimes they won't take
you. Oh, of course.
Submit.
Yes.
So how is that different from a freelancer who tries to submit? I mean, how does that actually work? Are you, like, paid regardless of whether you get taken? You know what I mean?
Yes, I know what you're asking. It's, I think everything at the New Yorker is very, I don't know whether the word is Byzantine or Baroque, or, like, everybody's contract probably varies a little bit from other people's, depending also on when you got your contract. So for me, I got my contract in 1979, and it's, the main thing is that it's first refusals, so everything I do cartoon-wise has to, if the New Yorker rejects it, then I can sell it to somebody else. But in exchange, I got medical but they did away with that in 1986. That's probably TMI, but, you know, that's what the exchange pretty much is. But no, they don't have to take everything. And I think there are some people who did opt for some kind of salary thing. I don't know if it's really even have that. So yes. I sketch in pencil, although sometimes, like, for a finish, I definitely sketch it out in pencil, you know, just for composition and stuff. And then I ink, and then I put a wash on it. Yes?
I'm an editor, so I'm curious, does someone proofread the text?
Oh, yes.
Draw it?
Yes.
But you made an error. Do you go back and how does that work?
Well, the question is about proofreading. The New Yorker cartoons are famously fact-checked. You know, not just cartoons, the whole magazine is fact-checked, but cartoons, even cartoons are fact-checked. If it's a small error, they'll email me and say, "Can we take the hyphen out?" You know, and say, "Yeah, just put it in the drawer with the other punctuation. If you need one, you can take it out."
Somebody will actually work on your cartoons?
Yes. Yes, definitely. I'll tell you one funny fact-checking story that didn't happen in my cartoon, but Bob Mankoff did a cartoon where it was a bluebird at Bird of Happiness cartoon, and the bluebird was on the windowsill, and the fact-checker said, "This bird is actually," and the bluebird said something like, "Tweet, tweet, tweet, I'm the bluebird of Prozac," or something like that. And that was the gag line, and the fact-checker said that the bluebird was actually out of proportion, it was too big. And he said, "Well, I have news for you, bluebirds don't talk." My parents, they of course, passed away before this book came out.
Yes.
And when I would do cartoons about like a sort of mother character, my mother always did say to me, she would say, "I know that's me. You're drawing me." And I would totally lie and deny it. You know? I would say, "No, it's not. Mom, there's this called positive." Sure. And my children, when they were really, really little, there are times when I would use something funny they said without, you know, running it by them. When my son was 7, he went through a phase of asking these incredible questions that I started writing down. And I didn't sell it to the New Yorker, I sold it to the sciences. It was things like, some questions I could understand where they came from. Like, is there a horrible tasting oil that they give kids? And then I realized that he must have seen some cartoon with castor oil in it, you know. Do you have to get special markings to go to China? I don't know. There was one question I could not understand this one. How much do wigs cost? And then there was a second part of that question. Could they cost $1 million? And I was like, what? Where does this question come from? So I did use that. But when they got a little older, I would ask them. Like the thing with my daughter, when she said, "Mom, you're burning me," like, I definitely, you know, ask her. Anyway, thank you so much.
Yeah.